We may transition from our last guest to the guest that we have on the line, and we use Chester's own Ethel Waters as she sang a song in 1930. What Did I Do to Be So Black and Blue? Because where Ethel Waters left off, Dr. Marlene F. Watson has picked it up in her work and in her life's work, as she has asked the question, why are so many African Americans unhappy in their relationships, in their families, and just simply by being in their very own bodies? She answers that question in her brand new book, which is entitled Facing the Black Shadow. It's an intimate look at the ways Black people struggle against a pervasive belief in Black inferiority, which she calls the moniker the Black Shadow. We are honored to have her on the line. She is an associate professor and the former chair in the couple and family therapy department at Drexel University. She's also a licensed therapist and has been pondering this work both in her personal life and in her social and professional life. We're honored to have her on the line. Dr. Marlene Watson, how are you doing? And welcome to the airwaves of WURD, by the way.
Hi, how are you? I am doing well. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I did that tune as you heard me, and you were you familiar with that Ethel Waters tune?
I was not.
I'll tell you why I did that, and I'm going to start off by having you tell a story that you did in your book. I picked a 1930s tune because very early in the foreword or somewhere early on in your book, you tell a wonderful story about looking into your grandmother's eyes and her telling you something when you were a child, and then her saying something else a little different after she had dementia years later about her own skin color and appearance. Would you tell that story and begin to talk with our listeners about what brought this on your heart and mind to address this very important topic?
Yes, I would be happy to tell that story. When I was a child, my grandmother would call me in about the same time each day because she lived by a railroad track. And the train would come at a certain time each day, and when it came, it would rattle the china in her china closet. And she would always say, Brazolia's here. And that's her sister who had passed years before. I never met her sister, Brazolia. But she would tell me that I looked like her, and she would say, you're pretty, like my sister, Brazolia. And I was just eager for that compliment each day. It was just a delight to hear her say that, and this is my beloved grandmother, I'm her beloved granddaughter, I am excited to hear this. But then, when my grandmother is suffering from dementia, I go to visit her one day in a nursing home, and I always needed Al Green, Precious Lord, when I went. So I would play that in my car because it was very painful to go there and to see my vibrant grandmother now suffering from dementia. And this one particular day I went, my grandmother was just having a stream of consciousness where she was saying, I'm not the pretty one. Brazolia was the pretty one. I'm black and ugly. Mommy loved Brazolia. She was the pretty one. And I was just stunned. And my grandmother was just having this conversation. And what was so impactful to me was that here she has dementia, but through the dementia is her lifelong pain around having been the darkest daughter. That was just profound for me. And in that moment, I started to think much more about it. I had worked around external racism, et cetera, but I started to think much more about this, that if that persists when you have dementia, Alzheimer's, then there's something really to this that should be explored.
See, and it's amazing that you started off your book in telling that story, which would become in part your life's work, an aspect of your life's work. My grandmother, the late Emma Wilson, lived to be 92. And had dementia as well. And she was, for lack of a long description, you know, a brown-skinned, you know, African-American woman. And I didn't know, and of course, if you saw me or if you knew me, I'll just say by point of reference, because it's I'm making these comments because it's what we're going to talk about within the context of your book. But I'm light skinned. But in the 70s, when the afros came out, she would always say, "Boy, you know, don't wear your hair in that long afro. You've got good hair," and blah, 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 blah. By the time she had her dementia, it was the first time I ever heard her use the N-word. Never before that in my life. Never, 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 never. And she revealed more of, you can call it looser associations, you can call it whatever you want to call it in clinical terms, but she revealed how unattractive she had felt she was because she was a brown-skinned woman. And we just thought that she wasn't getting it in the 60s and the 70s when we started using the words, as the rest of America did, black to describe herself. She never would, because for her, the pairing of the word black in her generation was always paired with the slur, the N-word.
Yes.
She just refused it. She just couldn't. And as you talk about eloquently in your book, whether it's the N-word or other words, she just couldn't reclaim black. For her, she couldn't reclaim black and see it as positive. What's it been like for you to, do you feel like, and I want to say the title of your book again for the listeners, Facing the Black Shadow. Certainly, you're not the first person that has addressed the topic matter, but I would suggest still in 2013, it's still important that we have these public and private conversations. And in some way, you are in a good way outing, you know, kind of our stuff. And I guess I'm wondering what that journey is like for you to out our private pain and suffering about our skin color and our race this way.
I started changing the focus of my work to look at internal family, black family dynamics. And I recall talking to colleagues, telling them that I was going to do this. And, of course, there's a lot of concern and worry. What are people going to think? How will that change the conversation of external racism? And we need to be concerned about that. So you have those types of legitimate concerns. But we suffer inside our families from some things that we can change ourselves. And then we can be better allies to one another to counter-resist, to fight against external racism.
I'm nodding as you're saying it. You know, and you know, one of the things that we do well on this radio station, if we were in totally open format, I would dare say, or however many hours we're in open format throughout the day, you know, you would get a number of people. I think, and I could be wrong, watch the phones light up as I say this, but I tend to think that people in the 40s, 50s, and 60s bring a certain set of passions and or experiences, you know, about the race issue. And I would think in some ways the younger generations, although there have been progress, they didn't experience some of the things that some of us experience. So I guess I'm wondering, as you have explored these very private, you tell the story in the book, for example, that you have an image on the wall, I believe, in your office.
Yeah.
And you could be treating a powerful, educated, articulate, you know, so-called person, or, you know, so-called less educated person. And in this one case, there's an attorney. He looks up in the image and it's the third session, and he begins to share how troubling the image is for him. And for me, that's private pain. Do you think most of us are carrying around that pain? And would you tell the story of what that image was?
Yeah, it was an image of slaves picking cotton, and he became very disturbed by it. And I, told him that I thought it was important for us to honor slaves and slavery, to remember it. And he was very disturbed by it because he himself was experiencing feelings of inferiority. And he worked in a very, you know, high-powered law practice and felt that he was being treated pretty much as if he did not have much competence because of being black. But that was something that he didn't want to talk about, because so often the message is that, you know, you blame the man, you shouldn't do that, or you're using the race card, and therefore don't speak about it. And in not speaking about it, we are internalizing that pain, and it's going to come out physically, mentally, and spiritually.
Excellent. And what I like about your book, although we, whoever the we are, the listeners and folks are over, we may have had conversations on some levels, dialogues about this. I guess I'm most impressed by your therapeutic bent. So it's not just topical or superficial conversation for you. You've rolled up your sleeves, you've thought about, you've worked on, you've created exercises. How do we begin to, you know, in very personal and intimate therapeutic ways, how do we begin to address, you know, this structural ingested, you know, self-hatred that you call the black shadow? In fact, I want to use your definition or part of your definition from page 12, and then we'll take a short break.
Okay.
The black shadow is a psychological dynamic. It's a way of thinking and responding to the world from a deep-seated belief in inferiority of black people, ourselves included. It tells us we are N-words, ugly, worthless, defective, undeserving. The black shadow's domain is our unconscious minds. So when we think of these negative thoughts about ourselves and other blacks, or when we make choices or act out from these beliefs, we're not aware that it's the black shadow poisoning our minds. That's a huge problem, because it means we simply accept that our critical, judgmental, rejecting thoughts and actions are correct and even appropriate. We'll take a brief break, and that's very well written, very well articulated, and we're going to explore that even more, and maybe in a few minutes we'll take some more calls and comments from you. So stay close. We'll be right back. 900 AM WURD, on air, online, of course, in the community. I'm Dr. Richard M. Cooper. The program is The Karamu, The Feast. It's about 25 minutes after the hour. We're honored to have on the line Dr. Marlene F. Watson, one of the country's foremost African-American couples and family therapists. The brain trust of her new book is entitled Facing the Black Shadow. It is a personal and professional journey, and it's a great, great read. But it's also a workbook. Before we took a break, I read a portion of your definition regarding the black shadow. It's a psychological dynamic. How long did it take you to work on this this construct, this typology, this idea, to develop it and lay it out?
Actually, it was about 6 months, because I was very intent on developing this idea and this book. Now, that's the writing of it. Of course, I've had patients over the years. My grandmother, her dementia, and family dynamics, and my own story. And so it's much longer, but in terms of putting it all together, developing it, it was about 6 months doing that.
Yeah, and I don't, and although I should, because I teach in a clinical program, but I don't think that this is going to be significantly covered in the new DSM-5, I think, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, if you will.
I can assure you that will not, because I'm sure it's still primarily white males who are making those decisions.
Absolutely. From your perspective, you do a really good job of tying in specifically the impact and the significance of history. And that's why I'm using music, and I have some other stuff to use when we come out of the breaks, but I'm using music because, you know, some would say that for whatever the reasons, when blacks, African Americans, black folks use kind of self-effacing, you know, language and lyrics to describe their own, you know, skin and hating it, or why was I born this way, or what's wrong with me, you know, that type of thing. I think to me that demonstrates both historically and at present, you know, that the issue is still very, very, very much prevalent. Would you talk about what are some of the significant markers of history, be it slavery or Jim Crow, that continue to historically shape this phenomena for African Americans?
I think we have to first look at slavery. That's the root. That's where the lie of black inferiority began. and the corresponding lie of white superiority.
And how do you see it in both your, from a counseling perspective, how do you see it in various forms manifested? And you point out the plenty of examples in the book, in persons, in terms of, how they see themselves, how they hate themselves, how it impacts on their relationships with others.
Interestingly enough, I'll share one person's story. In her head, she was white. She lived in a white world. She was like a porcelain doll, and her imagined husband was white, and she had a lot of pain around being dark-skinned. So that song you played by Ethel Waters really could have been her story. She couldn't understand why she was black, and what she would do is get involved with white men who would, pretty much have sex with her and then leave, not stay. And it was only when she began to look at what that meant for her and how she thought about herself as a dark-skinned black woman that she then could begin to connect the dots and understand that in allowing herself to enter into these meaningless relationships with white males, that she could, for the moment, tell herself that she was chosen and that she was special because she had the attention of a white male. But then she hated herself still when those relationships ended. And she began to talk about that and then look for ways of dealing with how she thought about herself. And she had grown up in pretty much of a white environment and had not been the person that had been chosen. A lot of times our children are in schools that may be predominantly white, or even if they're in schools that are predominantly African Americans, a lot of times it's lighter girls that are chosen. And one of the things I want to say about my work is that history is critical to it, because many times we just look at the symptoms of it and we start pointing the finger at one another, and it becomes, pretty much a blaming process, as opposed to us taking it back to the root and understanding where it began and seeing ourselves as victims that don't have to remain in a state of victimhood, but to use that information to empower ourselves and to deal with it directly instead of hiding behind secrecy and denial that this stuff is all taken care of, it no longer exists. It does exist. After slavery, racism persisted. Even to this day, we know that from having a black president and how the conversation often is toward him as an African-American male in the White House.
Yes, yeah, and I agree with you. I've always said to students, other folks, and not that I said that this was the desire, but I said if there were only people of African descent left, African Americans and so-called other Africans, whatever folks call themselves, left, we'd still have to deal with internalized oppression. It still would be there. And I think on some levels, as you write about and have thought about this and help to heal people, it's the things that we do when we're by ourselves that can show that this just isn't some pathology that we have. It came from somewhere. So little things in my generation and to this day that some people do, like looking at the baby's earlobes to see how dark he's going to be, fingertips, or these long conversations about the hair texture the baby has, when he or she is born. But oh no, that gonna change. They ain't gonna get that good hair, And I'm saying in my own extended family, so I won't say names because it's embarrassing and it's sad. But it's how do you begin to, in those very personal spaces when they're, the other isn't around, it's just us, so-called being us. How do we begin to help us to get some insight that some of the origins of that behavior, as we define ourselves, is by somebody else's standards and historically somebody else's hatred of us?
That's right. I think we have to become intentional about it. Recently, a friend shared with me that she was in a hair salon and the conversation became one of how she speaks. Pretty much, they didn't say, you sound like a white girl, but pretty much that was the intent of the conversation. And they said, oh, we're just teasing you. And she began to defend herself because she felt badly that they thought that she was somehow being too proper. And I said to her, you know, this represents the black shadow on both ends. First, there's that internalized inferiority message that blacks are not supposed to be able to speak a certain way. And then there's the fear, the corollary fear that I won't be able to speak that way. And with her, my friend, who was able to speak that way, there's the fear that I won't be accepted because I'm perceived as not one of them because I'm behaving or speaking in a way that's more identified with being white. And those are things that we definitely have to deal with. We have to be honest about them and have genuine conversations. You know, every so often it comes up who's black, who's not. But let's talk about these real issues and, you know, stop seeing it so linearly and begin to see that it is a systemic issue because it came from somewhere. It's not just blaming whites for your misfortunes, but it is acknowledging the racism that has created barriers, constructed walls in people's lives, and the looking at the internalized oppression that you spoke about and understanding that not everybody can move from that place, and that as long as anybody is still pretty much held down by that, that we need to be concerned about it as a larger community.
Yes, it's funny. In preparation for this conversation with you, you know, I was doing some homework, of course, reading your book and doing some other things. And I found, and I was looking for the audio now, I have it somewhere, but I found there was a story, recent story within the last year of South Africa of black people where the utilization of And it's funny, I think of this stuff from the 50s and 60s perspectives for black people in America, but these products, the skin lightening creams, are still being sold in the open market, Jamaica, and I'm not saying it's not being sold in Philly either, because I don't know every store, but the heyday of this stuff, where it was in Ebony and in the magazines and so on, I thought was in the 50s and 60s. Well, lo and behold, these products are being still sold all around the world, found to cause all kinds of secondary, you know, problems, and in fact, there was this, this artist, female artist from South America who went through a procedure to actually become lighter and was very proud of it. So it shows that this dynamic that you're talking about just doesn't find itself here in America.
No. And also, look at hair. I don't know if you've seen, but I've seen babies with long hair weaved into their hair, and it's like they can barely hold their little heads up. Now, even though it's braids, but the point is, what would organize us to do that to a baby's hair, not thinking about the damage that it may be causing? And I pretty much contend that it's still that carryover about I can't change skin color. So hair is the other folly that nature has, you know, given to us, and therefore, let me do what I can about this hair.
Yeah, you point that out. You point out words are very important, be it the word ghetto, be it humor. I mean, you really have a broad gaze of aspects of culture that kind of show us, and I'm using your language, the black shadow in its multiple and varied forms. And you've also lit up our phone board. And we'll take calls at 215-634-8065, toll-free worldwide, 866-361-0900. If you're listening on the internet, if you're listening on your iTouch iPad, hit us up. Oliver's calling in from North Philly. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely.
And God bless you. I'd like to bring something to the table that I think most of your guests can speak about or focus on.
Right, as long as you don't say Afro-Americans, because I've heard you say this a few times, as long as it's something different. Okay.
But listen, I got to speak up for what... It's a black radio station, and I got to say what I feel, and that's all I'm bringing to the table.
No, but long as my point is, as a listener, I've heard you explain this many times.
That's
so,
right.
So long as it's not the same thing, I'm in. Otherwise...
Well, I'm going to try to clarify what I said. You give me a minute or two, that's all it's going to take.
All right. I hope it's more of a question than a comment of what you usually say, but go ahead, brother.
Well, I'm trying to get all people on the front row, and I like to get right to the point, if it's okay with you.
You're on. Go ahead.
All right. For nearly 400 years, we've been carrying the weight of the whole black race on our shoulders, on our backs and shoulders, because we are good-hearted and a compassionate people who didn't know the difference. One of the reasons was that we'd eat out the same pot, only on a different table. Today, we might eat out the same pot, but let's try to eat on the same table, one for all and all for one. Maybe then we can do something as a collective to help our position right here in America. Teach our children about our own struggle, what our ancestors have been through, like the Latinos were telling you about their people, what our ancestors have been through here. And once we understand what we've been through and teach our children to love and respect each other, then and only then can we be in a position to help ourselves, to come together under the concept of Afro-Americans, Americans of African descent.
Thank you. That's perfect. And that's exactly why you should read the book, because that's exactly what she's doing. Not so much specifically under that moniker, but it's she's doing it in a very process-oriented way to help people to begin to move forward. Talk about, if you would, some of the exercises that you've created in helping people in this journey to, I would say, to begin to heal themselves.
Yeah, one of the first exercises I think is necessary to help change the narrative is that of talking about the N-word with your children. I was listening looking at a show one day, and Angela Bassett was on it, and she talked about her twins, and one of her twins, I believe it was the son, who had come home, and he was telling her about somebody saying something to him that seemed to be in a racial vein. And I think it was Katie Couric, and she said, "What did you say?" And she said, "I said, well, you know, sometimes people are not going to like you just by the way your eyes look." Okay, that doesn't quite go deeply enough if it's about the child's race or something of that sort. We need to talk openly with our children about race. Because that helps them to have more pride in themselves. And just as the caller said, history is important, and we need to teach our children that history. So I think starting with a basic conversation, they hear that word, you take them to the movies, if you happen to take, or your children go, or somebody else that they're in contact with, and you still hear black actors using the N-word. Perhaps you don't hear whites using it because of political correctness, but you still hear African-Americans using it. And I don't care who uses that word. Encoded in that word is centuries of hatred for us and inferiority. And we've been an object of hate, so much so to the point that we have become self-hating. So that's one of the things that I really do think we need to do as an exercise. There are a lot of exercises in the book that...
Well, I'll hold you there for a minute. We're going to take a break, but that's a perfect one. And I'm also going to have you look at... You pay, which I think is excellent, very copious attention to what people do. And you taught me something on page 72 that we're going to talk about after the break, and that's E.T. from Outer Space. I haven't heard that little song or didn't know what it was. So I read your book, you know, this little polemic, this little rhyme about E.T., and then lo and behold, I found it all over the internet that children are singing that, and we adults don't even know what they're singing and how they're describing themselves. And I'm going to use that when we come back as an example. Stay close. We'll be right back. This is a very important book. Our guest is Dr. Marlene F. Watson, associate professor and the former department chair in couple and family therapy. Before we took a break, you pointed out in your book something, many things that I'd never heard of. I'm just going to read a little of that ditty poem phrase, and I looked it up. I'm going to have you talk about it. E.T. from outer space. He had an ugly face, sitting in a rocket, eating Betty Crockett, watching the clock go tick-tock, tick-tock, shawada, wada, tick-tock, shawada, wada, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. You better get your dirty black hands off me. I got the moon shock, black eyed peas, freeze. Talk about where that came from and why it's important.
That song came from my niece. My niece went to a friend's school. I came home one day and I was very excited to see Anique. She was excited to see me. She began singing that song. And I stood kind of quiet listening to that song, and it was just so startling to realize what that song was teaching her about herself. And these songs sometimes are ballads of self-hatred that we do not pay attention to that our children may be playing or singing. I asked Anique, where did she get that song? She said she got it from someone at school. I asked her if only black children played it. She said no. All children played it. And I asked her, where were her teachers when they were playing this song, singing this hand clapping song? And she said they were not paying attention to them on the playground. And then I had to decide, how was I going to handle this? Because Anique was young at that time. And I said to Anique, well, if children of all races play this, then is it fair to say, get your black hands off of me? And you don't say, get your dirty white hands off of me? And she could think about the concept of fairness. But so often we don't tune in to what actually our children are singing or what they are playing that may be teaching them self-hatred.
I'm with you. I mean, you a few pages or paragraphs later, you talk about, I'm just going to quote you, race lessons. We raise our daughters. We love our sons. God bless the child who's got her own. Black men ain't no good. Black women are controlling. These are just some of the lessons taught at home and in the community that perpetuate. And I think what's really important about what you do is that you give it a referential name. And I think it's helpful to have a language for something that we're talking about other than saying internalized oppression. You know, I do think it's important for you to say, well, I've labeled this the black shadow. This is what it is. Now, what's your thought or feeling about how do we begin to remove, ameliorate the black shadow? How do we make it go away? How long does it take? What's been some of the tough cases that you've had? It's taken a longer amount of time to help, you know, to begin to get people to eliminate or lessen the impact of the black shadow.
Well, I have a pretty long case of a gentleman. He's in the book. And he's a lot better than what he was, but he still goes back to that sense of not being good enough as a black man, not feeling like a black man, because he was invisible to white women. And he knew that that really meant to him that he wasn't worthy as a man. And he really struggles with that still in some ways. He is a lot better. He understands that, but it comes up for him. And he has to grapple with not needing a white woman to make him feel as if he is completely whole.
Well, and the thing about it is that all of this, from within the perspective of a continuum, it's extremely painful. It's extremely personal. How in your training and your therapist experiences, your educator experience, have we reached the point where others, other than, we'll say, people of color as therapists, are able to work on this issue? So if I have a white therapist, are they taking on this skin color, you know, issue with their black or other clients of color from your perspective?
I think it's still difficult for many non-therapists of color to do this because, first of all, they would have to be clear about their own story and be able to hold then yours. And a lot of times, the story for whites is that they aren't raced, meaning that white is the norm, and so white is really not a race, that it's only people of color who have a racial identity. And in so doing, they deny their own story, which created, you know, race, and they became just the norm. And then it is difficult for them to handle your strong feelings and emotions sometimes. I have students all the time that I say to, you cannot just sit and wait for a client to bring up racial issues before you address them. And a lot of the students, white students in particular, think that they should only deal with it if a client brings it up. And how well they deal with it, even if the client brings it up, is questionable because they don't often deal with themselves. Therefore, our training is a lot around the self of the therapist.
See, and it's funny you said that, and I'm assuming, but I won't ask you, you don't have to answer this question, but I'm assuming that Drexel's going to adopt your book in the curriculum, in one of the courses, or one of, and other than the ones that you're teaching. I say that because we seem so willing to be able to take, you know, Freud's notion of Greek mythology and supplant that onto, you know, psychoanalytic theory and how we understand and misunderstand thing, and I hate my father because he's sleeping with my mother because that's what Freud said, and that's the Oedipal complex.
Yes.
We're so willing to put that Greek archetype or this fantasy archetype of somebody else, you know, into the reality of our teaching human behavior and therapy and training in the classroom. But yet we don't see, still in 2013, we see few of the expressed realities of African Americans place in the context of the core knowledge, not just as the addendum, you know, this little half an hour that we do on black folks. And for me, I find that to be very troubling. So I'm hopeful that your book will be adopted both in your school and I would argue for the rest of the world. And it's an interdisciplinary kind of a tool.
Yeah, I really hope so. But you know that we are woefully behind in that happening.
What's been, I know your book's fairly newly released, what has been the reaction, what has the talking circuit been like for you as you begin to get the word out about this book and others have begun to pick it up?
Well, actually, you are my first media interview.
I like to be first, so that's a good thing. I like to get you before Oprah and Tavis and all those people. That's a good thing.
I am hopeful that I will get to speak about it more. But a lot of times, this is not the kind of book that gets the attention.
I say yes, but by the same token, if we think about your book from the perspective of, you know, and I'm not the healing cottage industry, and one of our favorites, let's say one of our favorites in this industry is somebody like, we'll say Iyanla Van Zandt. Certainly, I'd love to see her interview you, Oprah, because, you know, the healing color consciousness work, gender, cultural orientation that she brings to it. It seems like your book would be very, very, you know, viable and akin to some of the things that she does and talks, you know, and talks about. I also, it seems to me, and correct me if I'm getting this part wrong, it seems to me that the book is as well, though, a manual for people that want to go through it, explore it, use it in the event that they couldn't see you themselves, say, in private practice, because you can't treat and see everybody.
Right. It is. It absolutely is. One of the things I was most concerned about was writing a book that a lay audience could easily pick up and find usable, not just have it be in academic institutions, because sometimes those books just stay on the shelves. As opposed to people really using them, and especially if it's an academic institution that's predominantly white. I wanted this book to be hands-on for African-Americans.
Yes, and I like the fact you use from popular culture music to historical Aesop's Br'er Rabbit to everything in between. It really is a good read then for people to connect, you know, see aspects of the culture, popular culture, history, slavery. So, I mean, you've really come up with, I think, a pretty solid workbook and a very broachable and a very usable tool. In fact, I would suggest as well for persons who work with young men and young women, it would be a great rites of passage kind of a tool, journaling. It would be a good, like a group book club read. And then, although what I would do in a book club is that I would slow down and say, we're going to talk about chapter one this week, do Absolutely. An exercise, as opposed to the whole read, you know, like read it all and then come and talk to it. I would slow it down, you know, a little bit and have people actually work through it.
Absolutely. And, you know, most of the larger churches in particular have various ministries. I'd like to see churches get involved in these kind of conversations.
Actually, churches is that'd be a great, great, that's a great location, great, great center for it as well. How can persons get more information about you and get access to the book?
Okay, this book can be found on most e-readers, Amazon, Nook. So whatever your e-reader device is, you can find this book. And if you want a printed copy, then you can contact me at mfwatson7@gmail.com. And on my website, which is www.drmarlenefwatson.com, I have strategies for healing that people can just go to and read for themselves. There are more in the book, but there are some there.
You have a very nice website. I've been there. Very well done. Very well put together. I would think, too, as the word begins to get out, publications, I would think that there's going to be a solid market for your book once others review it, whether it's Essence and African-American publications, radio stations like WURD, we just did,
yes.
to get the word out. I imagine it's going to really catch a fire. Do you have any lectures, any speaking engagements coming up in regards to the book?
Not in the area. I'll be going to Fairfield University in Connecticut in May, but not in the immediate local area yet, as yet.
Excellent. If somebody in that audience tapes video, audio tapes something, I could see some great excerpts that could be posted on YouTube and at your website as well about the book, which would be great.
Well, thank you.
Excellent. It has been a pleasure. You know, I'm going to be bugging you all the time now that we have formally connected, and plus you're local. I can't thank you enough for your time. And I want to just talk to you in regards to some other professional activities and things.
Okay.
So give the title of the book again.
Facing the Black Shadow.
And tell people the cost, because they always want to know that.
The e-version is $8.99, and the printed version is $12.95 plus $5 shipping.
Great. So we say only $12.95 and only $8.99 and only $5 for the shipping. Somehow the word only makes it all so much sweeter.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for your time and your work, and we'll talk again soon. You take care.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Bye.
All right. And again, family, that was Dr. Marlene Watson, brand new book out. It's funny. I always, you know, you find out about books, films, and whatever. I'm always dashing to be early on the front end. So it's a pleasure. We're going to take a pause for the cause. And when we come back, we'll talk to, I'll call it John Gross Squared. That's John Gross times 3. We'll be right back. Stay close.